Chapter 14.
"I've no wit, Nastasya Philipovna. That's what makes me talk too much," cried Ferdyshenko, beginning his story. "If I were as witty as Afanasy Ivanovitch or Ivan Petrovitch, I should have sat still and held my tongue tonight, like Afanasy Ivanovitch and Ivan Petrovitch. Prince, let me ask you, what do you think? Don't you think that there are many more men in the world thieves than not thieves? And that there isn't a man in the world so honest that he has never once in his life stolen anything? That's my idea, from which I don't conclude, however, that all men are thieves, though goodness knows I've often been tempted to. What do you think?"
"Oh, how stupidly you tell your story," commented the sprightly lady, whose name was Daria Alexeyevna. "And what nonsense! It's impossible that everyone should have stolen something. I've never stolen anything."
"You've never stolen anything, Daria Alexeyevna? But what will the prince say? He's blushing all over."
"I think what you say is true. Only you exaggerate very much," said Mushkin, who really was for some reason blushing.
"And you, prince, have never stolen anything yourself?" "Fool! How absurd this is! What are you thinking about, Mr. Ferdyshenko?" the general interposed.
"You're simply ashamed to tell it when it comes to the point, so you try to drag the prince in, because he can't take his own part," Daria Alexeyevna snapped out. "Ferdyshenko, tell your story or hold your tongue, and don't drag in other people. You put one out of all patience," said Nastasya Philipovna sharply and irritably.
"In a minute, Nastasya Philipovna. But since the prince has confessed, for I insist that the prince has as good as confessed, what would anyone else, to mention no names, say, if he wanted to tell the truth for once? As for me, gentlemen, there's no need to tell more. It's very simple and stupid and nasty, but I assure you I am not a thief. I don't know how I came to steal. It happened the year before last, one Sunday, at Semyon Ivanovitch's villa. He had friends dining with him. After dinner, the gentlemen were sitting over their wine. It occurred to me to ask the daughter, a young lady called Maria Semyonovna, to play the piano. I walked through the corner room. On Maria Ivanovna's work table lay a green paper note for 3 rubles. She must have taken it out for the housekeeping. There was no one in the room. I took the note and put it in my pocket. What for, I can't say. What came over me, I don't know. Only I hastily went back and sat down at the table. I sat on there, expecting something, in considerable excitement. I chattered away without stopping, told anecdotes, laughed. Afterwards I joined the ladies. About 30 minutes later they missed the note and began questioning the maids. They suspected one called Daria. I showed extraordinary interest and sympathy, and I remember that when Daria was utterly overcome, I began persuading her to confess, assuring her that her mistress would be kind, and I did that aloud, before everyone. Everyone looked on, and I felt extraordinary pleasure in the fact that I was preaching to her while the note lay in my pocket. I spent those 3 rubles drinking in a restaurant that night. I went in and asked for a bottle of Lafitte. I never asked for a bottle like that by itself. I wanted to spend the money at once. I felt no particular pangs of conscience at the time, nor have I since. I shouldn't do it again, certainly. You may believe that or not, as you like, I don't care. Well, that's all."
"But there's no doubt that's not the worst thing you've ever done," said Daria Alexeyevna with aversion.
"That's a pathological incident, not an action," observed Totski.
"And the servant?" asked Nastasya Philipovna, not disguising her intense disgust.
"The servant was turned away next day, of course. The family was strict."
"And you let that happen?"
"Oh, that's good. Why, could I have gone and told it myself?" chuckled Ferdyshenko, though he seemed struck by the extremely unpleasant impression made on all by his story.
"How loathsome!" cried Nastasya Philipovna.
"Why, you want to hear of a man's worst action, and yet you expect something brilliant?"
"A man's worst actions are always loathsome, Nastasya Philipovna.
We shall hear that directly from Ivan Petrovitch. And a great many people are brilliant on the outside, and want to seem virtuous because they have their own carriage. All sorts of people keep a carriage. And by what means?"
Ferdyshenko, in fact, was quite carried away, and flew into a sudden rage, positively forgetting himself and overstepping all bounds. His whole face twitched with anger. Strange as it seems, he apparently had expected a very different reception of his story. These errors of taste, this special sort of bragging, as Totski had called it, happened very frequently with Ferdyshenko, and were quite in his character. Nastasya Philipovna positively quivered with fury, and looked intently at Ferdyshenko. He was instantly quelled and relapsed into silence, almost cold with fear. He had gone too far.
"Hadn't we better make an end of it?" Totski asked artfully.
"It's my turn. But I claim my right of exemption and shall not speak," said Titsin resolutely. "Don't you want to?"
"I can't, Nastasya Philipovna. And in fact I look upon such a petit jeu as out of the question."
"General, I believe it's your turn," said Nastasya Philipovna, turning to Epanchin. "If you refuse too, you will throw us all out, and I shall be sorry, for I was reckoning on finishing it by telling an incident from my own life. Only I wanted to do that after you and Afanasy Ivanovitch. You must give me confidence," she added, laughing.
"Oh, if you promise to," cried the general fervently. "I am ready to tell you of my whole life, and I confess I have got my story ready for my turn. And from His Excellency's air alone one may judge of the peculiar creative pleasure with which he has worked up his anecdote,"
Ferdyshenko ventured to observe with a sarcastic smile, though he was still rather ill at ease. Nastasya Philipovna glanced at the general, and she too smiled to herself, but her depression and irritability were obviously increasing every moment. Totski was more alarmed than ever at her promise to tell something herself.
"It has happened to me, friends, as to everyone, to commit actions in my life that were not very pretty," began the general. "But it's strange that I regard the brief incident which I'll describe directly as the basest action of my life. It's almost 35 years ago, yet I could never escape a twinge at heart, so to say, at recalling it. It was an extremely foolish business, however. I was at that time only a lieutenant, and was working my way up in the army. Well, we all know what a lieutenant is. Young blood and ardour, but a miserable screw. I had an orderly in those days called Nikifor, who was awfully zealous on my behalf. He saved, sewed, scrubbed and cleaned, and even stole right and left anything he could lay his hands on to help our housekeeping. He was a most faithful and honest man. I was strict, of course, but just. We happened to stay for some time in a little town. I had lodgings in a suburb, in the house of the widow of a retired sub-lieutenant. The old lady was 80, or thereabouts. She lived in a little ancient tumble-down wooden house, and was so poor she didn't even keep a servant. What was worse, though, she had at one time had a numerous family and relations. Some had died, others were scattered, while others had forgotten the old woman. Her husband she had buried 45 years before. Some years previously, a niece used to live with her, a hunchback woman, as wicked as a witch, so people said. She'd even bitten the old woman's finger. But she too was dead, so that the old lady had been struggling on for 3 years quite alone. I was frightfully bored there, and she was so silly one could get nothing out of her. At last she stole a cock of mine. The matter has never been cleared up to this day, but there was no one else could have done it. We quarrelled over the cock, quarrelled in earnest, and it happened that as soon as I asked, I was transferred to other quarters, to a suburb the other side of the town, in the house of a merchant with a large family and a big beard, as I remember him. Nikifor and I were delighted to move. I left the old lady indignantly. 3 days later, I came in from drill, and Nikifor informed me, 'We were wrong, Your Honour, to leave our bowl at our old lady's. I have nothing to put the soup in.' I was surprised, of course. 'How so? How was it the bowl was left behind?' Nikifor, surprised, went on to report that when we were leaving, the landlady had not given him our bowl, because I had broken her pot. That she had kept our bowl in place of her pot, and that she had pretended I had suggested it. Such meanness on her part naturally made me furious. It would make any young officer's blood boil. I leapt up and flew out. I was beside myself, so to say, when I got to the old woman's. I saw her sitting in the passage, huddled up in the corner all alone, as though to get out of the sun, her cheek propped on her hand. I poured out a stream of abuse, calling her all sorts of names, you know, in regular Russian style. Only there seemed something strange as I looked at her. She sat with her face turned to me, her eyes round and staring, and answered not a word. And she looked at me in such a queer way, she seemed to be swaying. At last I calmed down. I looked at her. I questioned her. Not a word. I stood hesitating. Flies were buzzing. The sun was setting. There was stillness. Completely disconcerted, I walked away. Before I got home, I was summoned to the major's. Then I had to go to the company, so I didn't get home till it was quite evening. Nikifor's first words were, "Do you know, Your Honour, that our landlady is dead?" "When did she die?" "Why, this evening, an hour and a half ago. So that at the very time I was abusing her, she was passing away." It made such an impression on me that I assure you I couldn't get over it. The thought of it haunted me. I dream of it at night. I am not superstitious, of course, but 2 days after, I went to church to the funeral. In fact, as time goes on, it seems to haunt me more. Not that it haunts me exactly, but now and then one pictures it and feels uncomfortable. I've come to the conclusion that the sting of it lies in this. In the first place, it was a woman, so to speak, a fellow creature, a humane creature, as they call it nowadays. She'd lived a long life, lived too long. At one time she'd had children, a husband, family and relations. All this bubbling, so to say, smiling, so to say, life about her. And then, all at once, complete blank. Everything gone. She left alone like some fly, accursed from the beginning of time. And then at last God had brought her to the end, as the sun was setting on a quiet summer evening. My old woman, too, was passing away. A theme for pious reflection, to be sure. And then, at that very moment, instead of a tear to see her off, so to say, a reckless young lieutenant, swaggering arms akimbo, escorts her from the surface of the earth to the Russian tune of violent swearing over a lost bowl. Of course I was to blame, and though from the length of years and change in my nature I've long looked at my action as though it had been another man's, I still regret it. So that, I repeat, it seems positively queer to me, for if I were to blame, I was not altogether so. Why should she have taken it into her head to die at that moment? Of course, there is only one explanation, that what I did was in a certain sense pathological. Yet I couldn't be at peace till 15 years ago I provided for 2 incurable old women in the almshouse, so as to soften the last days of their earthly existence by comfortable surroundings. I think of bequeathing a sum of money to make it a permanent charity. Well, that's all about it. I repeat that I may have done wrong in many things in my life, but this incident I honestly consider my worst action. And instead of the worst, Your Excellency has described one of your good actions. You've cheated, Ferdyshenko, commented Ferdyshenko.
Yes, General. I never imagined you had such a good heart after all. I'm almost sorry,
Nastasia Philipovna dropped carelessly.
Sorry? What for?
Asked the General with an affable laugh, and not without complacency He sipped his champagne. But it was Totski's turn, and he too had prepared himself. Everyone thought that he would not, like Titsin, refuse, and everyone, for certain reasons, awaited his confession with curiosity. At the same time, they were watching Nastasia Philipovna. With an extraordinary air of dignity, which was in keeping with his stately appearance, Afanasy Ivanovitch began in his quiet, polite voice to tell one of his charming anecdotes. He was, by the way, a man of fine appearance and dignified carriage, tall, rather stout, a little bald and turning grey. He had soft, pendulous, rosy cheeks and false teeth. He wore his clothes loose and well cut, and his linen was always exquisite. His plump white hands were pleasant to look at. On the first finger of his right hand, he wore a costly diamond ring. All the while he was telling his story, Nastasia Philipovna was staring intently at the lace frill of her sleeve, and kept pinching it with two fingers of her left hand. She didn't even once glance at the speaker.
"What makes my task easier," began Afanasy Ivanovitch, "is the absolute obligation of describing the very basest action of my life. In that case, there can be no hesitation. Conscience and the prompting of the heart dictate at once what one must tell. I confess with bitterness that among all the innumerable, perhaps frivolous and thoughtless actions of my life, there is one, the impression of which has lain almost too heavily on my mind. It happened nearly 20 years ago. I was staying then in the country with Platon Ordintsev. He had just been elected Marshal of Nobility, and had come down with his young wife, Anfisa Alexeyevna, to spend his winter holidays there. It was a few days before her birthday, and two dances had been arranged. At that time, that charming novel of Dumas Fils, La Dame aux Camélias, was in the height of fashion and was just making a great sensation in society. It's a work which, in my opinion, is not destined to die or tarnish with age. In the provinces, all the ladies were in ecstasies over it, those at least who had read it. The charm of the novel, the originality of the situation of the principal character, that enchanting world analysed so subtly, and all the fascinating incidents scattered about the book, for instance, the use of the nosegays of white and pink camellias alternately, all these charming details, in fact, and the whole ensemble, made an overwhelming sensation. Camellias became extraordinarily fashionable. Everyone wanted them. Everyone was trying to get them. I ask you, is it possible to get many camellias in a country district when everyone is asking for them for dances, even when there are not many dances? Petya Fohovsky was breaking his heart at the time, poor fellow, over Anfisa Alexeyevna. I really don't know whether there was anything between them. That is, I mean, whether he had any real grounds for hope. The poor fellow was crazy to get camellias for Anfisa Alexeyevna. By the night of the ball, the Countess Sotsky, a visitor from Petersburg, staying with the governor's wife, and Sophia Bespalov were, we knew for certain, coming with nosegays of white ones. Anfisa Alexeyevna longed to create a special sensation with red ones. Poor Pieton was almost driven distracted. Of course, he was the husband. He promised to procure the flowers, and what do you think? On the very eve of the ball, they were snapped up by Katerina Alexandrovna, a terrible rival of Anfisa Alexeyevna in everything. They were at daggers drawn. Of course, it was a case of hysterics and fainting fits. It was all over with Pieton. You may well believe that if Petya had been able to contrive a bouquet somehow at that interesting moment, his chances would have greatly improved. A woman's gratitude in such cases is boundless. He flew about like a madman, but it was an impossible achievement, and it was no use talking about it. All at once I met him at 11 o'clock on the evening before the birthday, and the ball given by Madame Zubkov, a neighbour of Ordintsev's. He was beaming. "What is it?" "I have found it! Eureka!"
"'Well, my dear boy, you do surprise me. Where? How?'
"'At Fethekshesk, a little town 15 miles away, not in our district. There's a merchant of the old style, a rich man called Trepelov, living there with his old wife. Instead of children, they keep canaries. They've both a passion for flowers, and he has camellias.
Why, it may not be true. What if he won't give you them?
I shall fall on my knees and grovel at his feet till he does. I won't go away without.
When are you going?
Tomorrow at daybreak at 5 o'clock.
Well, good luck to you.
And you know, I felt so pleased on his account. I went back to the Odintsevs. 1 o'clock at night came, and you know, I was still thinking about it. I meant to go to bed when suddenly a very original idea came to me. I made my way to the kitchen. I waked Savely, the coachman, gave him 15 rubles, and said, "Let me have the horses in half an hour." Half an hour later, of course, the sledge was at the gate. Anfisa Alexeyevna, I was told, had a migraine. She was feverish and delirious. I got in and drove off. Before 5 o'clock, I was at Fefekshesk, at the inn. I waited till daybreak, and only till daybreak. By 7 o'clock, I was at Trepelov's. I said this and that, and asked, "Have you any camellias?" "My good, kind sir, help me, save me. I bow down at your feet." The old man was tall, grey-headed, severe, a terrible old man. "No, no, on no account. I can't consent." I plumped down at his feet. I positively flopped on the floor. "What are you doing, sir? What are you about?" He was almost alarmed. "A human life is at stake," I shouted to him. "Well, take them if that's so, in God's name." I did cut those red camellias. They were wonderful, exquisite. There was a little greenhouse full of them. The old man sighed. I pulled out 100 rubles. "No, sir, don't insult me in such a way." "In that case, my worthy sir, devote that 100 rubles to the hospital here for the food and expenses there."
"Well, that," said the old man, "is a different matter. That's a good and noble work and pleasing to God. I will present that money to the hospital as a health offering for you." And you know, I liked that old Russian. He was, so to speak, Russian to the backbone. De la vraie souche. Delighted at my success, I set off homewards. I went back a roundabout way to avoid meeting Petya. As soon as I arrived, I sent the bouquet up to Anfisa Alexeyevna to greet her when she waked. You can imagine her delight, her gratitude, her tears of gratitude. Pyotr, who the day before had been at his last gasp, was sobbing on my breast. Alas, all husbands have been the same since the creation of lawful matrimony. I won't venture to say more, but poor Petya's chances were completely over after that episode. I expected at first that he would murder me when he found out, and made ready to meet him. But what happened, I would never have believed. He fainted. By the evening he was delirious, and next day he had brain fever and was sobbing like a child and in convulsions. A month later, as soon as he was well again, he volunteered for the Caucasus. It turned out quite a romance. It ended by his being killed in the Crimea. By that time his brother, Stepan Vorhovsky, was in command of a regiment. He had distinguished himself. I confess I had pricks of conscience even many years afterwards. Why, with what object, had I dealt him such a blow? And it's not as though I'd been in love myself at the time. It was simple mischief for the sake of flirtation, nothing more. If I hadn't snatched that bouquet from him, who knows? The man might have been alive to this day. He might have been happy. He might have been successful. And it would not have entered his head to go to fight the Turks.
Afanasy Ivanovitch ceased speaking with the same stately dignity with which he had begun his story. The company noticed that there was a peculiar light in Nastasya Philipovna's eyes, and her lips quivered as he finished. Everyone was watching them with curiosity.
"They've cheated, Ferdyshenko! How they have cheated! "This really is cheating!" cried Ferdyshenko in a lachrymose voice, realizing that he could and must say something.
"And whose fault was it that you didn't know better? You should learn from these clever people."
Darya Alexeyevna, an old and faithful friend and ally of Totsky's, snapped out almost triumphantly.
"You are right, Afanasy Ivanovitch. The game is a very boring one, and we must end it quickly,"
Nastasya Philipovna commented carelessly.
"I'll tell you myself what I promised, and let us have a game of cards."
"But the promised anecdote first of all,"
the general assented warmly.
"Prince,"
Nastasya Philipovna turned sharply and unexpectedly to Mushkin.
"My old friends here, General Epanchin and Afanasy Ivanovitch, want me to be married. Tell me what you think. Shall I be married or not? As you say, I will do."
Afanasy Ivanovitch turned pale. The general was petrified. Everyone stared and craned forward. Ganya stood rooted to the spot.
To whom?
Asked Mushkin in a sinking voice.
"To Gavril Ardalionovitch Ivolgin," Nastasya Philipovna went on, in the same harsh, firm, and distinct voice.
Several seconds of silence followed. Mushkin seemed struggling to speak and unable to pronounce a word, as though there was some awful weight on his chest.
"No, don't marry him,"
he whispered at last, and breathed painfully.
"So it shall be, then. Gavril Ardalionovitch,"
she addressed him imperiously and, as it were, triumphantly,
"you have heard the prince's decision? Well, that is my answer, and let it be the end of the matter once for all."
"Nastasya Philipovna," said Totsky in a trembling voice. "Nastasya Philipovna," pronounced the general in a persuasive but agitated voice.
There was a general stir and commotion.
"What is the matter, friends?"
she went on, looking at her guests as though surprised.
"Why are you so upset? And how distressed you all look!"
"But remember, Nastasya Philipovna,"
Totsky muttered, faltering,
"you have made a promise quite voluntarily, and might have partly spared—" "I am at a loss, and, of course, perplexed, but, in short, at such a minute, and before people— and to do it all like this, to end a serious matter by such a petit jeu, a matter affecting the honour and the heart, a matter involving—"
"I don't understand you, Afanasy Ivanovitch. You really don't know what you are saying. In the first place, what do you mean by before people? Are we not in the company of dear and intimate friends? And why petit jeu? I really meant to tell my anecdote, and here I have told it. Isn't it a nice one? And why do you say that it's not serious? Isn't this serious? You heard me say to the prince, 'As you say, so it shall be.' Had he said yes, I would have given my consent at once, but he said no, and I refused. Isn't that serious? My whole life was hanging in the balance. What could be more serious?"
"But the prince, what's the prince to do with it?" "And what is the prince, after all?"
muttered the general, almost unable to restrain his indignation at the offensive authority given to the prince.
"Why, what the prince has to do with it is that he is the first man I have met in my whole life that I have believed in as a sincere friend. He believed in me at first sight, and I in him."
"I have only to thank Nastasya Philipovna for the extraordinary delicacy with which she has treated me."
Ganya, pale and with twitching lips, articulated at last in a quivering voice,
"It was, of course, the fitting way, but the prince in this matter—" "Is after the 75,000, do you mean?"
Nastasya Philipovna broke in suddenly.
"Did you mean to say that? Don't deny it. You certainly meant to say that. Afanasy Ivanovitch, I had forgotten to add, take back that 75,000, and let me assure you that I set you free for nothing. It's enough. It's time you too were free. 9 years and 3 months. Tomorrow a new leaf. But today is my birthday, and I am doing what I like for the first time in my whole life. General, you too take back your pearls. Give them to your wife. Here they are. Tomorrow I shall leave this flat for good, and there will be no more parties, friends."
Saying this, she suddenly got up, as though she meant to go away.
"Nastasia Philipovna! Nastasia Philipovna!"
was heard on all sides. Everyone was in excitement. All rose from their seats and surrounded her. All had listened uneasily to her impetuous, feverish, frantic words. They all felt that there was something wrong. No one could explain it. No one could make it out. At that moment there was a violent ring at the bell, exactly as there had been at Ganya's flat that afternoon.
"Aha! Here's the way out, at last. It's 11:30, cried Nastasia Philipovna. "I beg you to be seated, friends. Here is the way out."
Saying this, she sat down herself. A strange laugh quivered on her lips. She sat in silent and feverish expectation, looking towards the door.
"Rogojin and his 100,000. Not a doubt of it," Titsin muttered to himself.